What's up, everybody? This week I'm joined by Greg as we discuss a movie whose special effects and story still hold up 25 years later. 1997's Men in Black. That and a whole lot more is to come on this week's episode of the 90s Podcast. Welcome to the show. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the 90s Podcast right here on the Because Movie Network. Hope you're doing well today. And this week, I'm joined by Greg Gregory. Greg, how are you, brother?
Hey, good. What's up, buddy? Good to be back.
Yes, it is. And it's sad. It's a sad day today as we're doing our Season 10 season finale. But we're going to do Men in Black. And we're going to be. I'll give you more details of what's coming up later on in the year at the end of the episode. But it's good to be here for today anyway, at least.
Yeah.
So how you been, man?
You know, just hanging in there and just really been busy mostly. House stuff, you know, just having a baby and all that good stuff. She's a toddler now, so she's walking around and grabbing stuff off shelves. So we're having to constantly like move stuff up higher and baby gate this area and, you know, go on a no tour. No, don't touch that. No, don't touch that. But anyway. It's been really busy.
From about 15 months old to 4 years old, they rule the house. That's
pretty much.
Yeah.
They dictate the timing and the staging of just about everything in the house, yeah.
I remember those days. My case, they were so long ago. Because my youngest is 17.
Wow.
Yeah, we had him young, so... Because I'm 40 now. I try and get that in there every time I can.
Younger.
But
I had a buddy who was like 10 and his mom was like 25.
Oh wow, yeah, that's
in high school. Yeah, so that's or tough. No, not middle school, elementary school, whatever.
Yeah, that's a tough one to deal with right there.
Yeah, they just got to work early, I guess. Yeah.
Well, they're kid free quicker than I am anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's 40 now and his sister's 38. So yeah, they're way kid free.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's yeah, like I said, I'm looking forward to being kid free. Not because of
anything.
Yeah,
I love my kids.
I love my kids.
But it'll be cool.
I love my kids. I love all my kids. I love all the kids I've brought in. I love all the kids that I've birthed. That Sarah's birthed, that I've been a part of and
helped birth,
yeah. But I'm looking forward to the day where I can walk around my house naked.
There you go. it's about the simple things in life, man.
It's simple things in life. But we're not here to talk about child rearing. We could be here all day about that with our experiences and stories. We're here to talk about the 1996 classic Men in Black.
Yeah.
Opening thoughts?
I mean, it's just one of those movies that... that pretty much everybody's seen.
Yeah,
it's like one of those quintessential movies.
Yep.
Like if you were gonna send off a time capsule to a different planet to give people an idea of what the culture was like right around this time, this movie would have to be in there.
Oh yeah,
you could argue that if you did a decade, like a multi-decade one, that it would have to be in there too, or just like a best of.
Yeah,
just because it's I don't know it's. It somehow had mass appeal while still being edgy and a little bit over the top.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty excellent feat because, you know, parents seem comfortable with their kids seeing it. You know, it even though it did have a little bit of raciness and a couple of dirds in there. So, I mean, they kind of just wowed you with the whole spectacle of it.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, we send in a space capsule for aliens to see how we would treat aliens on the planet Earth. I saw it in the movie theater when it came out, and it was one of the few movies I saw in the movie theater when I was a kid that age. Because I was playing soccer all the time, and you know, it just I didn't have time for movies. It was always playing, and.
Yeah,
got with a different group of friends for this you know trip to the, I say trip to the movie theater, and I was blown away by it. I mean, the special effects that they used were off the charts. They still hold up today. Not just they still hold up, but I'd argue that they're better than some special effects you see in movies today.
Yeah, definitely. I actually inspected it. Some of the more crazier ones, and found that it appears to be a combination of two or three different things they're doing to achieve some of those special effects. So they're using computers, but they're also using claymation, and they're also using photography, or not Photoshop, but trick photography, yeah, like they were at the time. So it's just really brilliant. Though you can tell they put a lot of care and attention into a lot of the CGI, especially the close-up scenes. Like we'll talk about one in particular that I completely broke down frame by frame. It's probably the biggest close-up CGI scene in the movie. It's a good one. You can tell they put a lot of time and effort to it all around, but especially that one.
Well, yeah, I think that one of the things they wanted to do was be faithful to the comic books and make it darker. And so they didn't want to do anything too cheesy. Now, of course, you got the one-liners, and you've got the action, and you've got the ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha, right? Because it does have some comedy in there. But it's not like... Not everything is played for laughs.
It does. Yeah, it's... It walks a line between a couple of different genres, because it's got good action. It's got a little bit of drama. I mean, most of these movies that we review that are really good, that's one thing they have in common. Groundhog Day, for instance, is it a comedy? I mean, sort of. Is it a drama? I mean, you could argue that. You know, you can almost argue it's a mystery, because we don't even really know why that. You know, so it's just another one of those movies that it's not one thing, but it's everything.
Groundhog Day's biggest mystery is how long did Phil Collins stay in Groundhog Day?
or you could argue how he got into that situation to begin with.
Yeah.
Sorry, I mean dehydrated Skittles.
It's okay. I just got the water here. But no, it's a real, real... I'd go so far as to say it's a cinematic masterpiece. It's a cinematic masterpiece that caters to mainstream moviegoers, if that makes sense. There are a few movies out there that try to do the cinema thing, and it doesn't really register with the public, the masses at large. But this did.
Yeah, it's you really hit it there, man. Like, it's like, I don't want to say it's like, I guess it has the energy of a avant-garde or like indie film, but with the bucks of like a slick Hollywood picture.
Yeah. And
I mean, you could also appreciate it just for like how clever it's put together and how everything's written and flows. It's just really just kind of moves really well.
But one of the things that I think really, really put it over the top was the choice of cast.
Yeah.
And we'll go into that here in just a second, because, you know, I'm looking at my notes, and this movie is, you know, like the nerd information, like it's a sci-fi comic book movie directed by Barry Sonfield, produced by Walter Parks and Laurie MacDonald. Production company was Columbia and Parks and MacDonald. It was released on July 2nd, 1997, and it did $590 million at the box office with a $500 million profit. Okay,
wow.
Fair enough. You know, critical rating 8.5 out of 10. Again, you know, great. But there really wasn't any drama coming into this movie. There's no interesting facts about this movie other than it's based on the comic book series Men in Black. And Parks and MacDonald bought the rights in 1992. Okay, fair enough. But the only kind of drama that they had is they wanted Barry Sonfield to direct it. And he was busy at the time doing Get Shorty. But as soon as he finished Get Shorty, he came right on board. And, you know, that's the background of the movie. Because the cast was, believe it or not, the cast was first choice for everyone. They got everyone they wanted. They wanted Will Smith because of his, you know, wisecracking, young, you know.
Street tough kind of demeanor. Yeah, he just looks like a kind of a no-nonsense, like, just say what's up, say it how it is. Yeah, totally.
And they wanted somebody straight-laced to be his partner. And you can't get any more straight laced in 90s movies.
Don't talk about his wife on stage.
No. Just don't. I've always said this. If it was The Rock up there, he would have sat in his seat and just put his head.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The Rock could bench press him with his pinky. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't have done anything either.
No. And no. He actually came back to the wrestling and didn't tear his bicep this year.
He's like 50 now? He's, like late 40s?
He's late 50s now.
Really?
Yeah, he's I think he's 57.
Like the sauce.
Yeah, he's not 57, he's 53. Excuse me, he's 53.
Okay. He's holding up well.
He's holding up well for his age. And like last time he came back to do with the wrestling stuff, he tore both his pec muscles.
Howie.
Yeah, so this time he came back and didn't do that, and you know, made a lot of money.
Good.
So good for him. But if he was up there telling those jokes, G.I. Jane coming to see it next year, Will Smith would have sat in his chair and just smiled.
Then he would have went on Facebook and posted March safe from The Rock.
No, he would have complained to his publicist, who would have leaked it to E! News or something like that. Even to TMZ or something.
Yeah, he might have done some bellyache in a little non-direct way, but yeah, anyway. It was, you're right about that though, like the casting, like Chef's Kiss. I mean, even down to, I can never remember the guy that plays the main villain.
Oh,
yeah.
Vincent D'Onofrio.
And isn't he the guy in Full Metal Jacket?
Yes.
Yeah.
Private Pyle.
Really, really, really good, underrated. Another, like, C actor that you don't really, you know, probably don't get their full due as far as how brilliant and great they are. So, yeah, the cast is just phenomenal.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones was coming off a whole bunch of serious movies at the time. And I think this started the trend of serious actors doing comedy movies. Okay, not like Leslie Nielsen back in the 80s, where he only started doing comedy movies after that point. But the genre of you've got a comedic actor and a serious actor as a double act.
Right.
You know, and Tommy Lee Jones was spectacular in this movie.
Yeah, he played it perfectly, and he kind of played it almost like himself in a way, too.
I think he was trying to exorcise the demons of Batman Forever, where he went way over the top and tried to out Jim Carrey.
Oh, you can't do that. I can't do that.
No.
Yeah, that's getting bad for you.
And he didn't come off as anything playing Two-Face in that one, but in this one, playing Agent K was just, this was a part meant for him. You know?
Yeah.
Because the only other person that probably could have done it would have been Robert De Niro. Because you've seen his work in the Meet the Parents series. And, yeah. You know, he could have done it. But Tommy Lee Jones was just perfect in this one. Rip Thorne was awesome in it, too, as the boss Agent Zed. The great Tony Shalhoub was the pawn shop owner, Jack Jeeves. Brilliant, brilliant cameo.
Oh yeah,
I love Shalhoub. I really, really do. Oh, I forgot to point out Linda Fiorentino was as the as Dr. Lauren Weaver, the morgue. What's it called? The coroner.
The morgue doctor. Yeah, but she was in Dogma, right?
Yes.
She's awesome.
Apparently, according to Kevin Smith, though, she was a pain in the ass to work with. But.
Really?
Yeah, but Kevin Smith does have kind of a reputation of being of having pain in the ass people when it comes to bigger stars, like the Bruce Willis thing. You know, he didn't get on with Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah, okay, it just happens sometimes.
But he got on with Alan Rickman pretty well, so you know.
Yeah, he was brilliant in that too. He played it really dry, like Tommy Lee Jones' character does in here.
Yes.
Kay. I keep forgetting his name. It's Kay. Yeah.
Kay. Tony Shalhoub, you had Mike Newbossom as Mr. Rosenberg, and the Arkillian ambassador, Carol Striken, which I think that's Lurch in the Addams Family series.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. He's very, very recognizable.
And he was, again, he was only brought on because of Barry Sonfield. Because Barry Sonfield did the Addams Family and Addams Family Values. And mm-hmm. I didn't like Addams Family Values as much as Addams Family.
Yeah, it was Wayne's World 2, Wayne's World 1 all over again.
Yeah. It was a good movie. Yeah. If the first one wasn't as brilliant as it was, it would have been all right.
Yeah, yeah. They crushed under their own weight like the other one. That first one was awesome.
Yes. There's a bunch of cameos. There's a scene in the movie where they're tracking alien life on Earth. And not in a spy kind of way, but like, you know, to keep up with them, right? You know,
right.
Not in an investigation kind of way, just in a normal, you know, we're going to put camera up in your home to keep track of you. And they've got Al Roker, Danny DeVito, Sylvester Stallone, Dionne Warwick, Newt Gingrich, George Lucas, and Steven Spielberg. So it's implied that all those are aliens.
That makes sense.
I mean, Spielberg especially has to be an alien. The E.T.
I was going to say him or Stephen King. Just a novel machine. Or Buckethead, the musician.
Yeah.
I read today, I haven't verified it, but I read that he's written over 519 albums.
Wow. That's a lot. That's prolific right there.
Unfathomable.
If you got an album that's 10 songs, you're only going to release 30 albums a year after writing the...
Like I said, I haven't verified it, but I need to check it out because apparently he has a huge library.
Damn.
Massive.
See, and I thought Elton John's 40 albums was like a huge library.
It is a huge library.
But let's look in the plot for a minute.
Yeah, man.
All right. So this plot was brought from IMDb. So like a lot of my plots are, it's a couple of pages long, but we'll get through it. And I'll read the paragraph and we'll give opinions on the paragraph. Sound good? All right. So, in the middle of the Arizona desert, Nick the Dick is caught at a border stop with a truck full of immigrants. When he tries to claim he was fishing, the officers find the immigrants and instruct them to form a line. With Nick about to be arrested, a black car with Agent K and Agent D pulls up. Questioned, they claim to be INS Division 6, and they began talking to the immigrants in Spanish. When one fails to understand a word of it, they arrest him and send the rest back into Nick's truck and send them on their way. Their colleagues call BS and are sternly warned by K that they do not know what they're dealing with. K and D discover that the man is Mikey, who is a fugitive on the run. When Janice sneaks into the desert to see what's happening, Mikey goes into a rage and attacks him, knocking down D and K. K ends up killing Mikey as D's reflexes work against him, and K erases the memories of the immigration crew, excuse me, using a neuralizer. D admits he's getting too old for the job and probably retires. And because of that, D's memory gets wiped too. Now, that's a sad start to the movie. I mean, it's got some funny moments, you know what I mean? But it's a sad start to the movie when, you know, the guy wants to retire and he has an entire memory wiped of his working life.
His service, yeah. I mean, it's a bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a sad note, but it's also definitely moving it into a new chapter.
Yeah,
it's signaling that a torch is about to be passed. Something new is going to happen. Because I mean, it's hard, but I mean, when you have a job like that, there's a certain point where you realize that you're doing more harm than good continuing it if you can't be at your absolute best at all times.
Yeah,
if you could get yours, because it's not just about you. You could get someone else killed in the process.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of a sad to see that. We don't really fully know what's happening though when you're first watching it.
Yeah.
So that's part of it, is we're kind of looking through that with future vision now, knowing what the neuralizer does and how it works and stuff, or the flashy thing, if you like to call it. Okay. Yeah, it's a good use of a plot device to like keep it moving forward and to show that the new chapter is coming.
And not only that, if you look carefully, as he's chewing out the, as they're talking, not when he says, I'm going to, you know, I miss the star, I miss just looking at the stars, I'm getting too old for this. K Kay is already working on the neuralizer, so it's like Kay is already knows what's happening before he even says, "I'm done," and he's kind of getting it ready while he's while D is giving his speech, for lack of a better term.
Sure. Yeah.
So, okay, back in New York, a street young NYPD officer named James Edwards chases after a man through the city on foot. The man's extremely athletic and escapes him at every turn. Eventually, they arrive at the Guggenheim Museum, where Edwards apprehends him. The man pulls out a weapon, which immediately evaporates. After tying a handcuff in, the man escapes and leaps the wall in a single jump. Edwards breaks in the Guggenheim and runs up to the roof to confront him. The man claims he's coming and that the world will end. He blinks with gills under his eyes, which startles Edwards, then he willingly falls to his death. So, that right there is a great sequence. You know?
Yeah, it's cool. Just seeing, like, the really souped-up parkour.
Yes.
Essentially, like, supernatural. Like, you could tell immediately that this is not a normal thing. This is not a thing the humans can do. So, it's a definite... It's another indicator of a paranormal sort of slant on the movie, and it's a good overall sequence. The way it was shot, like you have a good perspective of every turn they make, and every time that he like jumps up really high, you get a good zoom out of that and stuff. It was very, very good.
Well, the other thing about it too is that you know there's aliens on the planet, so you instantly think that this guy's an alien.
Certainly, yeah, you don't know exactly what or why, but you at least know it. Yeah, he's not human. He's no human can jump, you know, 100 feet in the air and just like, woo.
Yeah,
you know.
If they switched the opening sequences around, you wouldn't have a clue what was going on. So I think the way that they produced it, you know, they've got they're both aliens and they're both the guys that you want to meet, you know, the main cast. But if they switched around, I think it would be a little different to kind of get.
Yeah, there's not enough context in that second scene. It's really dependent on that first one. So that's just good directing and good editing, and just having it flow correctly as a way as you reveal a little bit at once. You can't dump it all at once. You know, you gotta spread it out a little bit.
Well, in upstate New York, a grumpy farmer named Edgar verbally abuses his wife about a supper, saying that she is useless and the only thing that pulls his weight is his truck. As he yells that, a spaceship promptly crashes into it, destroying it by creating a crater. Edgar goes outside to investigate as his wife Beatrice stays in the house. Edgar then is killed by the alien, who steals his skin and uses it as a disguise. In the house, he confronts Beatrice and asks for sugar water. She mentions that his skin looks different and then is freaked out when he fixes it. And then he goes outside to salvage his spaceship. I love that scene where he just grabs the back of his head and like this.
Yeah, and she just, boom, she's out cold.
Edgar, your skin is hanging off your face. Just, you know. But
okay.
Back in New York City, Edward gives an incident report to his boss, who doesn't believe a word of it and steps out of the room. Local coroner Laurel Weaver, slides in to tell him that Edwards was right and it was extraterrestrial. When she leaves, we hear Kay neuralize her. There's the neuralization again, and I think you know exactly what's happening at that point.
Yeah, it's using it to cover up device. Yep. Obviously.
Kay steps in, unhooks the camera, and asks Edward about the weapon that evaporated. He asks Edwards if he recognized the weapon if he saw it again. He takes Edwards to Jack Jeeb's pawn shop. After a little persuasion, which involves Kay blowing off Jeeb's head, Jeebs then regrows a new head. Jeebs is then shown the guns, and Edward picks one he saw. Kay yells at Jeeb, thinking the weapon was used for an assassination attempt, and the alien who bought it was unlicensed. Kay neuralizes Edwards and decides he should join Men in Black. He gives Edwards a card. So that scene right there, special effects in that scene are absolutely phenomenal.
That was the one I was talking about, where like it was a multi-frame and you had like a transition that happened, like when he gets shot and then he regrows the head. That's one of the ones where there's multiple things going on. Like I'm not an expert on like video or CGI or anything, but just from what little I know, I can tell, considering the time period and everything, that they were physically editing, but also using a little bit of computer. So there's multiple things going on there. I actually slowed it down frame by frame. And if you watch it frame to frame, you can see a little bit of the editing on it, But overall, it's very, very good, and it's pristine for the time. I mean, it's ridiculous, but yeah, that one shot alone, full speed, it's one of the most believable shots in the entire movie, if not, you know, all of them are really good, but that one's just, it's perfect. It's really good.
This was in 1997, you know, so that's how brilliant it was. Okay, I own Lord of the Rings special editions, right? It sounds like a tangent, but bear with me. And one of the things that happened in around 2000 when they were editing the movies together was that a realistic fire pack finally existed. So they could, you know, all the fire that's in the Lord of the Rings is CGI. So they didn't have fire in 1996's CGI spectacular, but they could grow a guy's head in different stages where one eye's bigger than the other and the mouth comes in, and, you know, it's phenomenal what they did. That's why we said the special effects still stand up to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't look bad. It doesn't look old. It fits perfect. Yeah, the hues, the motion. Yeah, it's really, really good.
And it's not cheesy either.
No, it's very realistic. It's very believable.
So, the next day, along with some other government agents, Edward gets his training. First, a written exam, which I love the bit with the written exam with the table. He just yanks the table over to the other side of the room.
I think that was part of the exam.
Yes. I think everything that he did right for Men in Black standards, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
he was thinking, like, a little outside of the box.
Yes.
Which working in that, I'm assuming, would primarily need that.
That would keep him alive. That would keep him alive.
Right.
So, next is the target range where the recruits grab pistols and shoot a couple cutouts of extraterrestrials, except Edwards, who fires a single round at a little girl. Little Tiffany, why did she deserve to die? He explained.
Well, she was the only one that actually seemed dangerous at the time, sir. And how did you come to that conclusion? Well, first I was going to pop this guy hanging from the streetlight, and I realized, you know, he's just working out. I mean, how would I feel if someone come run up in the gym and bust me on my ass while I'm on the treadmill? Then I saw the snarling beast guy, and I noticed he had a tissue in his hand. I realized, you know, he's not snarling. He's sneezing. You know, ain't no real threat there. Then I saw a little Tiffany, and I'm thinking, you know, 8-year-old white girl, middle of the ghetto, bunch of monsters, this time of night with a quantum physics book. She about to start some shit. She's about 8 years old. Those books are way too advanced for her. If you asked me, I'd say she's up to something. And be honest, I'd appreciate it if you eased up off my back about it.
That's a wonderful, wonderful...
That's my favorite line in the whole movie. That's why I had to say.
That's a great monologue, though. I mean, that's one thing I like about this movie, too, is it got some real, real good monologues in there.
Yeah.
You know. But, yeah, I love that bit, too. So, K and Z debate the results and notice that Edwards is the right candidate. K pulls Edward aside while Z neuralizes the rejected candidates. He introduces Edwards to the history of Men in Black and then tells him the human isn't alone on the planet, making contact in 1961. K shows picture of first contact with an agent who brings aliens flowers. The world's flare was a cover-up to cover up the landing. And it's in there were 9 who made contact, including one dumb kid who got lost on the wrong road. K claims that aliens live among humans in secret. Edwards is skeptical, but K introduces him to the worms. Edwards is shocked and speaks more with K. K gives Edwards a few more home truths about the history and perception of Earth, and gives Edwards until sunrise the next day to think about John and Men in Black. And you want to talk about a monologue right here. Hang on, I'll pull up what he said exactly, because this is my favorite. This is my favorite bit. So Edward says, "Why the big secret? People are smart. They can handle it." And Kay said, "A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1,500 years ago, everybody knew that the Earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everybody knew the Earth was flat. And 15 minutes ago, you knew that humans were alone on this planet. Imagine what you'll know tomorrow." I love that line.
Yeah, because that's a very thought-provoking.
Well, it is true that you know, a person is smart, and society as a whole can be dumb. You know, I mean, sorry, but, you know, it kind of manifests in how we act and how we treat people. And, you know, and the hysteria that we get and over just mundane things, you know?
Right.
I mean, right now, as we're recording this, Congress just passed a TikTok ban. You know, I mean, we've got homeless veterans living on the streets. We've got kids not eating at school.
Housing crisis,
inflation crisis, and they ban TikTok as something that's going to help.
Yeah, that's from what I'm hearing, that's going to hurt a lot of small businesses who drive a lot of business but through content on there.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, we do YouTube here at Because Maybe Network, but I mean, you know, that's one of the reasons I haven't gone to TikTok, because they've been talking about a ban for all these years. You know, that's kind of hurt us, because I'm not going to post content on somewhere that's not going to be here in a couple of weeks, you know? And that's always been the mindset. But it just goes to show that once something is in somebody's head, it'll spread like wildfire to the people around them. You know, somebody said, if you hang around 9 broke people, there will be 10 broke people. You know? And
where are my rich friends then?
Right. But, you know, but you get the sentiment. You know, it's you know, as a whole, as the sum of our parts, society brings out the worst in everybody.
Yeah.
So, but that's why that's my favorite line in the whole movie.
Yeah, that's another. That's probably one of my favorites too, because it's true. He even has, you know, evidence to back it up. So, yeah, you could argue there's a lot of really good quotable quotes in this movie. It's just really well written overall, and the characters really sell it. So it's just
You know, it shows how good Will Smith as an actor is in the serious parts, that he's able to keep up with Tommy Lee Jones in the serious parts. Because, yes, we talk about Tommy Lee Jones keeping up with Will Smith doing the humor and the one-liners and stuff like that, but when it comes to the serious stuff, Tommy Lee Jones is a far better actor than Will Smith was at the time.
Overall, yeah, we had more experience and more chops, because you could argue Will Smith kind of played himself.
Yeah.
And because he kind of played himself in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air too.
Yeah.
So he was kind of typecast, and if they wanted that exact thing, they got it. And that was perfect for the role. So it worked out.
Ironically, the only movie where he doesn't play Will Smith is his debut, Made in America.
Yeah, because he's like a minor character, like a supporting role.
Yeah, he's like eighth billed or something like that. So, sure. But back to Edgar. He's at a rural farm where a bug exterminator heads into the barn and surprises the level of infestation of cockroaches. He's interrupted by Edgar, who believes that the vermin should be killed once and for all, then killing the exterminator and steals his bug trap with his spaceship hanging out of it. I love the fact that the spaceship is just... They cut a hole in the roof and put the spaceship, you know... Just
boom, yeah. Like it's a huge toaster and they're going to toast the spaceship.
Edwards accepts the invitation of John Men in Black. The next day, Edwards returns to MIB headquarters and is given a tour of how MIB operates. He notices that the HQ is a portal of the galaxy and notices a giant humanoid. He finds out that Men in Black is not a government agency and is self-funded by confiscating some gifts from out of town and pending them. So they say that the microwave oven, Velcro, and something else. I can't remember what the third one was. But it's always Velcro.
Yeah, and it's the invention of a lifetime. I mean, you're inventing someone that's got full utility, that's in every home, every business, there's Velcro on my body right now, on my cargo shorts. I mean, we've got it on bags. It's everywhere. Everyone uses it. So yeah, that's going to be a $1 billion product. That makes sense right there.
Yeah. Edwards is then initiated to MIB, where all his identifying marks are erased, as well as getting the last suit you'll ever wear, and is renamed Agent J. Edgar, in the meantime, follows a jeweler named Rosenberg around town in the exterminator's truck. Rosenberg seems to have an odd relationship with his cat. Now, that's foreshadowing.
Yeah, big time. When they directly show and tease the issue, the thing that they're looking for, multiple times throughout the movie, starting right there.
Jay is given his first assignment with Kay. Jay mocks the car that they need to drive in, a Ford POS. However, the car is faster than a normal car and has a red button on the gear shift. Kay tells Jay never touch the red button and to always wear a seatbelt. And then they drive off and Jay is like screaming and hollering because he can't, you know, he's getting thrown around this car because he's not wearing a seatbelt. He's not wearing a seatbelt. Can't click every trip. They follow Reggie Regic, an extraterrestrial living in New Jersey, even though he's restricted to New York City. Regic is in a rush to get off the planet with his wife, even though they have a newborn baby. Kay finds that that scene makes me laugh every time I do it. It's just a classic. Oh, yeah. It's like an Abbott and Costello Three Stooges thing. You know, it's the classic. The comedy's in the foreground, in the background, but in the foreground they're having a very, very serious discussion.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's one of my favorite things in comedy movies. I think Airplane did it real, real well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Big time.
And I know I mentioned Airplane a lot, but I love that movie. If this was the 80s podcast, we'd have done it like 5 times by now.
Right. Two and three parters. Yeah.
Yeah. Kay finds this unusual and decides to check out the news to see if anything has happened. He sees an article written in the supermarket tabloids, "Alien stole my husband's skin," and they go to investigate. Now, that's smart writing that says all those, you know, Globe and National Enquirer and Weekly World News and all that stuff, you know, tell the truth when it comes to all these weird and wacky stories about aliens.
No one will believe it.
And no one will believe it.
Because it's the tabloid, yeah. So it's all literally in plain sight.
There you go. Meanwhile, Edgar follows Rosenberg to meet another alien of the same race, who was the giant alien at MIB headquarters. Rosenberg's informed that a bug has landed on the planet and he must get off immediately. Rosenberg agrees, but requests lunch first. The waiter is asked to deliver their food, and we see a folded up dead man on the shelf. It took me about 5 different watchings of the movie to see that he was folded in half. I thought he was cut in half and stored there. I didn't realize he was actually folded.
Yeah, he just folded him in half and shoved him in the cart.
Yeah. I thought he was decapitated from the legs down.
That's fair, though. It's a quick shot, so.
Yeah.
It's shocking, so, yeah.
It turns out Edgar killed the waiter. Now, Edgar taunts the pair, who says that he may kill them, but they'll never discover the galaxy. Edgar then kills the giant and mortally wounds Rosenberg, stealing a black diamond case.
And they show the galaxy like 4 or 5 times during the sequence of events.
Yes.
Like inadvertently, but directly and a couple times as well. So they're already kind of teasing it a little bit. At this point, most people probably hadn't figured out that it was right in their face, but it was.
And a lot of people have probably figured out it's something to do with a cat, too, at this point.
Yeah, at this point you can tell the cat is connected somehow, at least. So
yeah.
Definitely.
Kay and Jay pose as FBI agents and question Beatrice. When Kay learns about the sugar water, Beatrice is neuralized and tells the wife that there was no alien and that Edgar ran off with an old girlfriend with a story to replace her erased memory. Jay convinces Kay to ad-lib the memory she gets and extends it. Kay analyzes the dirt that the alien may have left a spectral trail and discovered they are dealing with a bug. You want to say something? Sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine, it's fine. It lagged the first second there, and I lost you. I didn't know you were talking.
Oh, okay.
all right, Beatrice, there's no alien. The flash of light you saw in the sky was not a UFO. Swamp gas from a weather balloon was trapped in a thermal pocket and reflected the light from Venus. And then, not to do the whole thing, but the other one, Jay gets on to him about the story being kind of flimsy. He's like, on a more personal note, Beatrice, Edgar ran off with an old girlfriend. You're going to go stay with your mom a couple nights. You're going to get over it and decide you're better off.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because, he never appreciated you anyway. In fact, you know what? You kicked him out. And now you're going to go into town and go to Bloomingdale's and find some nice dresses, get yourself some shoes, find somewhere. Maybe you can get a facial and a hire a decorator and come back here quick. Because, damn.
That line always got me. Just like.
It's just so good. Like, it's just so jam-packed of stuff. There's so much there.
When Jay scoffs at the idea of a bug, Kay explains that bugs are a race of aliens, not unlike cockroaches, who destroy and cause chaos wherever they go. He tells Jay that with a bug in town, there's only one thing they can do: watch the morgues. That's kind of scary at that point. It's your first day on the job, and you realize that there's an alien race of cockroaches out there, superhuman strength, and that if they're on the planet, there's nothing you can do about it.
And you're less than 24 hours away from just finding out that we're not alone on this planet.
Yeah.
And all these other, so yeah, psychologically, it's a lot to take in. So yeah, that's pretty heavy right there.
Do you know what alien leaves a green spectral trail and craves sugar water? Oh, that was the answer on Final Jeopardy last night.
Ah, dang it.
So the police take the bodies of the giant and Rosenberg to the morgue, as well as Rosenberg's cat. Weaver examines the bodies and finds them unusual. J and K enter the morgue and pose as doctors so they can examine the body. They find a clasp on Rosenberg's ear and discover that Rosenberg isn't dead yet. The body of Rosenberg is just a host for a small alien who's controlling the body. His last words are, "To prevent war, the galaxy is on Orion's belt." K recognizes Rosenberg as a prince of the Aquilian royal family. He then repeatedly neuralizes Weaver before they head back to headquarters.
My one beef with this movie is, like, this K guy, like, I know he's been around a while, he's been doing this a long, but he knows everyone in the universe. Like, and he's like, "Oh, that's so-and-so from this quadrant in this galaxy, his wife." It's like, dude, really? Like, there's a, I mean, how many galaxies and stuff there are out there? That's pretty impressive.
That is impressive, but they also say that there's only, like, what, 1,000 people, aliens living on Earth at the same time?
Still, though, I don't think I can name 1,000 people.
No, true, but, I mean, like, if for example, out of those 1,000 people that come through, one of them's a prince, you're going to recognize the prince when they come through, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no. But when he's walking to the headquarters, he's, like, casually talking to people, you know, and asking, like, you know, he knew all that stuff about Reggie when he pulled him over.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, he's like a walking alien directory, like this guy. He has, like, alien Wikipedia built into his brain. Like, it's crazy. I get why they're doing it. They're showing his depthness and his
experience.
Breadth of experience. Like, he's this is cake for this guy. He does this all day long. It's just like putting pants on and walking to the fridge at this point. So I get that, but at the same time, it's just like, wow, that's you got a memory like a unbelievable, like a steel trap.
Oh, that must be due to the 37-hour day that they have.
Oh yeah, you get used to it after a while.
I'll have a psychotic episode. Just so casually with a psychotic episode.
The latter for me, yeah, I'd lose my mind.
Edgar is banging the stolen jewel case and repeatedly spills jewels from Rosenberg's jewelry store. Oops, excuse me, but not the galaxy that he's looking for. He resumes his search while Jay and K look at Orion's belt, but C thinks that he heard wrong. Jay finally sees the key is surveilling a random woman, which Jay figures out is K's wife, and his grumpy demeanor comes into focus. Jay also deduces that K was in the folder of the World Fair shown earlier as the guy who brought flowers and was most likely the one dumb kid who ended up on the wrong dirt road. They then discover that a bunch of aliens have left the planet, and they notice an Aquilian battlecruiser above the Earth conveying the message. K and Jay go down to Rosenberg's jewelry store to find more clues, and Jay is given a weapon, the noisy cricket. Now, I love the reaction to the noisy cricket.
Yeah.
he just holds it casually in his direction. He's like, "Whoa, kid! Whoa!"
Yeah. like he was holding a nuclear warhead or something. But, I mean, he might as well have been, you know. But, yeah, his disdain for it is really, really funny, too.
Edgar gets to Rosenberg's before Jay and K do, and he breaks in the door looking for the galaxy. He sees a picture of Rosenberg's cat, who is by his side at the time of death. Edgar sees a marble on the cat's collar, which he thinks is the galaxy. He notices the exterminator truck is being towed and goes to investigate. K and Jay arrive with their weapons and notice the havoc that has been wreaked upon the store, and Jay finds it unusual that anyone broken in without taking any of the jewels. They suspect the bug is behind it. When they hear a gunshot, they see Edgar walking away with a gun in his hand. Edgar gets the tow truck and drives away. Jay fires the noisy cricket, which to his surprise is extremely powerful. He fires the gun 2 more times when K tells him not to shoot in front of witnesses, but don't worry about the bug because they got his ship. K has Ed for a containment crew and is told the Arkillians want the galaxy. Now, I love that sequence. I really do. I think that that's another one with the special effects. Because, again, you know, they didn't have the good fire back in 97. That only came around in you know, early 2000s. But there are bits that catch fire. And, you know, they are important to the scene. So Edgar, in the meantime, is looking for the morgue and arrests a street vendor while stealing some postcards, then proceeds to go to the morgue from the map on one of the postcards. Weaver bonds with the cat and is amazed to find the jewel hanging from his neck. She finds out that the cat's name is Orion and that the jewel is the galaxy the bug is looking for. Now that, right there, that's a good shot of the galaxy.
Yeah, it's very good. You can see exactly, that's literally it.
It's better than any Star Wars, Star Trek shot at that time.
Oh, yeah.
You know. because Star Wars wasn't around at that point. It was all Star Trek at that point. To get information, K&J talked to an informant, an alien dog named Frank, but they're told the galaxy is on Earth and that it is tiny. J and K are confused, but when they see Frank bark at a cat, they know where to find the galaxy. Egger goes to the morgue and threatens Weaver for the cat. J enters the morgue and discovers that Weaver is being held hostage by Edgar, and that Edgar beat Men in Black to the punch. He escapes with Weaver and tells her to take him to the World's Fair, where they are working flying saucers. K tells Jay not to worry about him, since they have a ship he can't get off the planet. However, the Arkillian Fire warning shots say they will go to war within an hour. Back at HQ, MRB is racking their brains about the number of ships that are available on Earth due to the Exodus. After going through a handful of ships, Jay concludes that the bug is going to leave the planet via the flying saucers at the World Fair. I love that he, you know, his first day on the job, he's the new guy, and he's taking in as much information as he can, and he knows that, hey, old guys, do they still work? And they're like, oh, crap, you know.
Yeah, he's carrying his weight already.
Yeah, he's showing that
he has a nose for the business, and that's a reflection on Kay.
Yeah.
Ultimately, because he's extremely, extremely competent, extremely deft. So he had an eye for that.
And I think in Men in Black 2, and not to jump narratives, but in Men in Black 2, which we're not going to cover because that's a 2000s movie, Jay goes through multiple partners because he can't pick a partner.
Right.
With the Saw, whereas Kay knows exactly the characteristics you need to do this job, and bang, he's got them.
Yeah, exactly.
Edgar arrives to the World Fair before Jay and Kay. They drive through the Queen's Manhattan Tunnel, the Queen's Midtown Tunnel, excuse me, and manages it past traffic by pressing the little red button that allows the car to drive on the roof of the tunnel. Kay casually mentions that that Elvis is not dead, but went home. So Elvis in this universe is an alien.
That makes sense.
Well, you know,
Biggie and Tupac too.
Right. Considering Elvis got his only traffic ticket less than 3 miles from my house is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, he came through here quite a bit because he was from Mississippi. So I know he played in Louisiana a little bit.
Yeah, and in fact, the only sponsorship deal he ever did was for Southern Made Donuts.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Southern Made Donuts are not as good as the local donut shop down the street, by the way. So
really, really good.
While climbing through the saucers, Edgar eats the galaxy that he got off Orion's collar. Edgar drives Weaver with him, trying to get into the saucer, and Jay and Kay arrive just in time to save her. They shoot down the flying saucer, Edgar takes off in, and he gets out. The bug takes off the Edgar suit and reveals his true form. He then eats their guns, which they were given, you know, Will Smith, now that's what I'm talking about, when he's given like a shotgun type deal. And that...
Yeah, his is a snack.
Yeah. What was the line? Let me pull it up, see if they got the line on IMDb, because I want to get this one right. So they take the guns out the car. And hang on. Let me see. Give me a second. So they take the guns out the car. And it's like, you know, that's what I'm talking about, right? And hang on. Let me see if I got it. Okay, basically, Kay says a bunch of techno babble.
Right.
I need you to set the gun to. Yeah, it's not on here. And you set the gun to set. You know, he uses a lot of. You need to set the gun to set in 5, articulate 12 with the coefficient of, you know, something like that. Yeah. And Jay's like, huh? And he goes, oh, just shoot the damn thing.
Yeah. Right.
But that's another one of my favorite one-liners from this movie.
Oh yeah.
So after Edgar eats their guns, Kay attempts to get the bug to eat him to get the guns back, and Jay tells him not to get on the second ship and create a distraction for the bug. Jay begins fighting the bug by stepping on cockroaches he found in a local dumpster, and Kay shoots his way out of the bug's digestive system after he finds his gun, splitting the alien in half. They get the galaxy back and deliver it to the Arkillians. While Jay and Kay recover from their battle, the top half of the bug is still alive, but Weaver shoots the alien using Jay's gun, which was dragged out of his stomach, and tells J&K what an interesting job that they have. So she's in on the game now too. She knows what's up, even if it's only going to be for a couple of minutes before she gets flashy thinged.
Right.
So, as MRB cleared the situation, Kay and Jay arrive back at the city morgue. Jay begs Kay not to neuralize Weaver due to her job and how nobody would believe her anyway. Kay states that he's not training a partner, he's training a replacement. Mm-hmm. The battle with the bug was one last memory that he doesn't want to keep. Jay reluctantly agrees to neuralize him, which, like, that's just, that's really, really sad, you know? I mean, okay, with the one at the beginning with Agent D, you're not invested in the character yet.
Yeah.
You know?
You don't know anything about him.
So it's like, okay, they just wiped that old dude's memory. Now when it comes to Kay wanting to do it, it's like, You're practically screaming at the film. No, no,
you
don't
see
do
his
it.
Worth. You see his worth where he's at. So it's like watching Joe Montana go to the Kansas City Chiefs. It's like, you're so good where you are. Why? Yeah. So.
We then cut to a picture of Jay examining the hot sheets. One mentions that a postman from upstate New York called Kevin Brown has awoken from a 35-year coma. Happy to see Kay back in his old life, Jay meets his new partner, Agent L, which is Dr. Weaver. They mention that delegates from Soxie at 9 are looking for tickets for the next Chicago Bulls game, and they want to pull in a call to Dennis Rodman, who's from that planet. Dating the movie instantly right there.
Then
the camera zooms off, and we see two alien children playing a game of marbles with the galaxies. And that's Men in Black. Again, what a movie, right? It's we've used superlatives to talk about it and whatever, but I mean it still holds up. The story still holds up, the effects still hold up, and the acting still holds up. You know,
yeah, save a few dated references and some dated technology of the time.
Yeah,
which is just gonna happen. And they had the old school phones and earlier movies with the crank, you know, so it doesn't make it any less, doesn't make it a bad movie. It's just idyllic to the time. It just holds up and on every, just all of it. I mean, it's kind of a progressive story. It's one that kind of sounds almost futuristic.
Yeah.
And we're not to that point technologically. So it kind of suspends the idea of it being in the future in a way, even though it was set in the present. So yeah, holds up well.
This movie's got four main themes to it. Okay, first of all is secrecy, as Men in Black is the ultimate secret society. The members are routinely monitored, and anybody who has accidentally encounters them gets their memory wiped.
Right.
The deep level government agency started out as a government agency anyway. That is a conspiracy theorist's wet dream. I mean, it really, really is. You know, aliens are on the.
That kind of depth and breadth. All around of the aliens and of the reach of the organization. Yeah, the soggy dream come true right there.
And the members of Men in Black must have live in total anonymous existence. Like, they erase records of social security cards and birth certificates and passports and stuff like that.
Fingerprints?
Yep.
So they're everywhere and nowhere, nothing and everything, you know.
The other thing is philosophy. Now, they ask the question, are humans alone in the universe? I mean, it does in a way, you know? It's on a entertainment level, but are humans alone in the universe?
I don't think considering how big the universe is,
and
considering how many confirmed stars and planets and galaxies we've encountered, I think that it's more likely that we are than aren't.
Well, here's the thing.
Or are not alone. There's got to be something out there somewhere. Maybe we can't get to it. Maybe we can't see it or access it, but it doesn't mean it's not out there.
Well, they discovered on a planet close to us, within like 10 light years, what they think are city lights on a planet. So,
that's,
you know,
crazy.
It could be, you know.
Yeah, the tricky thing about that is that light takes so long to travel.
Yeah.
Say you were looking at Earth from a million light years away, you would see the Earth as it appeared 1 million years ago.
Yeah. And, you know,
so it's kind of crazy to think that light is still traveling to places, even though it's already happened and all the things have died. And
they're aliens. They're aliens who are headed this way, who are disappointed that they're not going to see the dinosaurs. They're going to see
they thought it was going to be woolly mammoths and dinosaurs and stuff. It's like, cool, we're going to harvest all these. Oh, no, what is all this other crap?
And they're going to see our dumb asses up here. You know, it's just...
Right, exactly. Well, at least we found the Simpsons. That was pretty cool.
Right.
You know, something out of it.
Futurama, Omicron, Percy, I Ate episode. I loved single female lawyer. You know, where the TV show finally gets them after 1,000 years and it's cut off because of some idiot spilled beer on the thing. But I mentioned Kay's speech earlier with the person smart, people are dumb, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the movie, it shows the galaxy is nothing more than a child's plaything, emphasizing that we may be minuscule in all terms.
Yeah, it's, I mean, perspective is everything.
Yeah.
What's huge to us on a cosmic scale is very, very small.
Yeah.
So on a cosmic scale, we are less than a speck of a fraction of a grain of sand. I mean, we're so, so incredibly tiny. So that's fair. I mean, how would we, if that were the case, how would we ever know?
Yeah, I agree.
Everything's so much bigger and we're so much smaller. So,
well, there's war. And the bugs and the Archaeans are a decade-long war. The bug wants to keep the war going and for species to have food, while the Archaeans will destroy anything to keep the bugs from getting their hands on the galaxy. Neither see Earth as important simply because of the implications of either side getting the galaxy. So the collateral damage is not important to either of them. And I think...
The other thing is most important.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that now, actually, you know, with all the wars going on in the world as we're recording, you know. Collateral damage is not seen as important enough.
Just just what they think is right, yeah.
Yeah, whether it is right or it isn't right, you know. It's a shame.
Subjective, yeah, depending on your perspective and what side you're on, totally, yeah.
Well, we've also got morality. And Kay shoots an innocent shopkeeper in the head in cold blood. Now, we as a viewer don't know his head's going to grow back. But he just very, very casually... Why have you got to lie to me, Jeebs? Bang.
Yeah.
You know, the memory erase, it's a cool tool for removing memories, but is that morally correct?
No.
For a secret society, you know what I mean?
I mean, it's a does the end justify the means situation?
Yeah.
And I think you could argue that you're protecting them a little bit as well. I mean, not just
true
protecting you from pulling you into, like, you know, alien presence that could be threatening or whatever, but you see how people who go down these rabbit holes, you know, for conspiracy stuff are, you know, some of them. So I mean, just imagine if someone had a real clue like that, it might ruin their entire life. Like, they might just ruin their life trying to figure out something that's actively being covered up over and over again, you know, literally. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, it, you're right, it's not morally correct, but in a way, they're kind of helping them out. They're kind of doing them a favor in a weird way. So it's a little...
Six of one half, dozen of the other.
Yeah, right.
Right. So let's go behind the scenes of the movie real quick, and then we wrap up. Now, I've mentioned this before. I mentioned this last week as I was previewing the episode on last week's podcast. The film was very, very faithful to the comic books and had an original plot that was complex, but it was changed at the last minute. Okay, so the Earth was supposed to be a rock from which two sides were shooting over. So, you know, you see the guy leaning over, shooting, you know, pulling back, waiting for the other guy to shoot, you know, that kind of thing. And what happened was the bugs were a third alien race coming to clean up the Earth after the Earth got destroyed for being this rock in the middle of the two wars fighting. The plot was considered too complex, so one of the races was wiped, and three scenes were edited in post-production. The pug scene, the waiter scene, and the message to Men in Black. Very few people knew about the plot changes, including the actors themselves. The only person who had a clue was Rip Thorne and the actor who played the pug. Everything else was done in post.
The dog is in the know more than anyone.
Right. To get the distinctive walk of Edgar, Vincent D'Onofrio taped his ankles and wore knee braces to lock his knees in place. Ow.
Yeah, it looked very stiff and awkward, but I mean, it looked believable. It fit the skin that he was in, definitely.
Even though the main actors were the first choices, they almost turned it down. Will Smith didn't believe that Spielberg was calling him and initially didn't want to take the part until G.I. Jane convinced him to do it otherwise.
G.I. Jane too.
Right. No, until Jada Pinkett Smith convinced him otherwise. Tommy Lee Jones only agreed if the script was improved, so they had to do rewrites to get him on board. Fine, fair enough. You know. So there were plans for this film to be set in government secret bases, but instead it was set in New York due to diversity.
Yeah, and its size, too. A lot of things you can work with there.
Animal rights groups made sure that none of the animals on set were injured during the shoot. Not just the cat, not just Frank the Pug, but the cockroaches, too.
Really?
I swear.
We have so many of them in the world. I think they'd be fine.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that that could have been seen as racist or typecasting or whatever was Will Smith's line about there are 1,000 people on Earth and all they want to do is just work normally. And Will Smith instantly goes, oh, cab drivers. Because a lot of immigrants in New York drive a cab. But no, that's actually a homage to book 4, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Sorry, I was just saying, I like when he tossed the cab driver out and then he threw the beaded cushion at him. That was so funny. That was a good gag. Anyway,
who invented the beaded car seat?
What is the benefit of it is what I want to know. It's like, I want a bunch of hard, awkward things jammed into my back for hours. Yay!
Yeah, no. My grandfather had one. It's just, ugh.
I don't get it, yeah.
But the film's success inspired Marvel to go into the movie business, with 2002 Spider-Man being the first one they shot after this. So, you know, this is responsible for Endgame, I guess you could say. After being asked not to call him Kid, Sport, Junior, so on and so forth, Kay calls Jay a pet name for the entire movie.
Oh, yeah. Consistently. And then he gives him, like, weird... names. He like calls him Dr. Black and Dr. White or whatever. He just keeps switching them. It's really funny. Subtle but funny.
Linda Fiorentino watched Bad Boys many times to meet Will Smith. Okay. That's a good movie to watch. We're gonna be talking about Bad Boys next season. So
he played himself a little bit in that one too.
Yeah. So. But he had Martin Lawrence to bounce off of that time too. So
yeah, they were really good at the time. Martin Lawrence was huge at the time. That was a big movie.
They wanted, from what I understand of Bad Boys, it was supposed to be Martin Lawrence's breakout movie, not Will Smith's. So, the movie gained criticisms for making some aliens coffee and smoking addicts.
Come on, you in America long enough, or the Earth long enough, that's going to happen. Some of them.
Tommy Lee Jones played a comic book character in this movie, and he played one in Batman Forever and will play several more in the future. Will Smith would stay out of comic book movies until Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I gotta check that out.
Many locations in the set are inspired by the 1950s and 60s space race.
Yeah, totally.
Bruce Campbell, aka Ash, was supposed to appear in a small role but pulled out. This movie would have been 1,000 times better if they had Bruce Campbell in it.
Yeah, just come in and just decapitate an alien real quick.
Goofy. There were 3 major changes to the MIB organization from the comic books. Men in Black mounted all paranormal activity on Earth. They wanted to shape the world rather than keep order. And Agent Day was a white guy, blue hair, blue eyes in the comics, but was changed race for the movie.
So they were only monitoring New York.
Yeah.
In the, yeah, so that seems a little more believable, a little more tangible.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that makes you wonder if there's other organizations similar to that elsewhere.
Well, then again, though, they did go to Arizona to stop the first one. So you know, maybe they do still come in there, and that's a bum note. Probably is a bum note. But no, I think this movie's an 8 out of 10 movie. What do you think, man?
Yeah, I would give it a 8.5. You know, it's just a great movie. It keeps your attention, and it's just I feel like they had a vision and they were able to really see it through with the cast and with the story and the plot devices and CGI. And just nothing really feels out of place. It all flows together really well. It's just, yeah, fantastic movie.
Oh, it was visually impressive for the mid-90s. The plot being streamlined, I think, did the movie a whole lot of good.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, and I'm going to say it again, that Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones' chemistry was perfect, which producers and directors have long since tried to replicate. You know, you have the energetic guy and the dry guy. You know, Tommy Lee Jones...
Yeah, so spot on, and just like, it's just, you don't want to have two people that are too alike, but you want them to have some things in common that so they can synergize.
Yeah.
And they just nailed it on that one. Yeah, that's like catching lightning in a bottle when you find chemistry like that.
I love the fact that all MIB agents are deadpan, and all the alien stuff is deadpan, and Jay is essentially freaking out at a lot of the stuff, especially the baby at the beginning, you know, that. When he goes to deliver the baby in the middle of the movie. I like the cast. The supporting cast, not so much. There was just a little bit of, you know, dryness there. That kind of brings it down a couple of notches.
It didn't focus too hard on them, though. I mean,
yeah.
It really only focused on so much on Edgar.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit of the doctor. But...
I'd say that it was mostly J and K.
Yeah, I mean, they did all the heavy lifting. I mean, let's face it. I mean, really, really, K had some of the best just lines overall, and like a lot of like J's lines came off the back of K.
Yeah,
and vice versa. They worked really, really well together.
Symbiotic team.
Absolutely, yeah. There was something else I was trying to find that he said. When he talks to Beatrice, he says, when they go to about Edgar, he says, "You're here to make fun of me too?" And Kay says, "No, ma'am. We at the FBI do not have a sense of humor. We're aware of. May we come in?" I just love that. Not that we're aware of. Just so incredibly dry and just like cut, just like to the point. You know, I like that.
There's something I love about certain words and certain phrases. When they add to a sentence, you know, when you hear something ridiculous and you hear the word again, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I fell off the jetway again. I mean,
yeah.
You know, just you know, it makes
it's just casual, very yeah.
But that is it for Men in Black. What a movie! I think we did a good job of getting of finishing up this season with one of the best movies of the 90s.
Yeah, it's just a rare bird. Just having the cinematography, the writing, the cast, the plot. Just we're all just kind of worked together beautifully in a movie that still keeps my attention and still keeps my interest to this very day, even though it's almost 30 years old. It's
like lightning in a bottle.
Telling you, man. Yeah, I mean, they just a rare win all around, and it was very successful. It's still successful. It's, you know, we talked about movies like this before, then games and stuff, when they're just classic. They don't really go anywhere. They get passed down to new generations, and this is one of these. I mean, I would argue it's a must watch, like family movie for kids, not too terribly young. You know, but, you know, like maybe my son's age, like between 10 and 13.
Yeah.
So I got to introduce him to it. I think he would love it.
Yeah, I think my folks would love it too. But my folks don't really watch movies that much. So it's really, really weird. You know, they don't play the video games that their peers play, like the Fortnites and the, you know, the Rocket Leagues and stuff like that. And that's going to come back and haunt me when calling it the Fortnites. Because I saw like you know, the mother where everything was a Nintendo except the Nintendo.
Right, yeah, you know? No, my mom, we just got you Nintendo. No, that's a Sega Genesis. I'm talking about the Nintendo 64. Oh, so it's a different Nintendo? Yes, Mom, yeah.
Now, this franchise was spawned two more movies. Men in Black 2, which was absolutely dreadful, and Men in Black 3, which was absolutely hilarious, because they got Josh Brolin to play Tommy Lee Jones playing Agent K.
Okay, I have not. I've seen one and two. I've never seen three. I need to find it. I'm sure it's probably on a streaming service somewhere.
Three is very good. It's definitely better than two, anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Like you said in the beginning, Wayne's World Syndrome all the way. Second one wasn't quite as good as the first, but I mean, the first one was just so good. It's kind of hard to recapture that magic.
No, that's true. That is true. So, all right, man. I think we're gonna call it a thing. Thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it. I know you've been busy these last couple of months.
Yeah, dude. I appreciate it.
We will be back here in a couple of minutes. Greg will be back at the beginning of next season, and I'll explain more about it when we come back. Take it easy, everybody. Thank you to Greg Gregory for coming on this week. I know Greg is super, super busy, what with being a father of a newborn and a teenager, and his work with the Holodex and his 8-to-5 and various other work that he does. And it's really, really good to catch up, and it's really, really good to have him on here for your listening pleasure. Good to have him on for Men in Black, and we will have him on sometime in the future. If you want to check what Greg is up to, go to theholodex.com/tour, and you will see where he's playing. And if he's anywhere near you, go check them out. A wonderful, wonderful show. And you will enjoy every second of it. I guarantee it. So that's good. Next week on our YouTube channel, stream 16 of the 90s Game of Dog Get My Homework Pokemon Red series. It is the next to last episode. We're almost done with this game. We haven't been playing it since October. So it'll be good to get this one in the history books. And yeah, we'll have more 90s Gamer coming soon. I'm just going to be glad that this is going to be done with, because like I said, we've been playing this for so long, and I just want to get this over and done with and finished and out the door and done. Like D-U-N, done. Over with. So I can bring you guys something else. What else am I bringing you? Well, on June 2nd, I'll be bringing you the first of a four-part series of New and Tasty. That's right. New and Tasty will be coming back to our dad streamer. Go check out our Twitch channel. It's going to be a four-part series where I play New and Tasty, and I get to the end, and I try and save as many of the 300 Madokans as humanly possible. After I played this game twice, I think I've explained the situation a couple of times. This time is the last time we're going to do it, and we're actually going to do it and complete it this time. And then, once we're done with that, on July 14th, we're playing a new Dead Streamer series of Fallout, a post-nuclear role-playing game, the very, very first Fallout game. And I will be playing that basically blind, deaf, dumb, whatever you want to call it. Never played it before to a long extent. I've done the first couple of rooms and I didn't really get the hang of it. I didn't know what I was doing. So I'm probably going to watch a few videos to learn how to do it, check out the manual and so on and so forth, and go ahead and play that game. Could be 5 episodes. I could throw my mouse at the monitor and call it good after 1 episode. I don't know. It depends on what we're doing. As far as the 90s podcast, this is the series finale, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, but you don't have to wait long for us to be back. In fact, we will be back on July 4th with a special episode on Independence Day. Greg will be joining me as we look at the greatest movie that Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum has ever done together. And that is the only movie that they've ever done together. Independence Day. So we're going to have Independence Day on Independence Day. I'm looking forward to that. Something to listen to while you watch a friend of yours light fireworks, set up a barbecue, or if you were in Britain, have a happy Thursday. Okay? if Britain took the time off every time country celebrate their Independence Day, they'd never go to work. I'm hoping there's one more Independence Day added to that list in the next 10 or 15 years, especially in my lifetime. But that's another story for another day. Yes, and then after that, we're going to take a month off, and our podcasting schedule will resume on August 4th as we bring you Season 11 of the 90s podcast, and I'm looking forward to bringing that to you. And that is all the announcements that I have. It is the end of the season. I I'm going to miss this for the next couple of months. I'm going to be doing it again in a couple of months, but that's okay. But I need a break. I need to do some research. I need to get everything done. I'm way behind in what I want to do. So, yeah, this is my way of playing catch-up. And, yeah, I want to thank everybody who's downloaded an episode this season. I want to take a chance to everybody who's downloaded it in the future. I appreciate you. I thank you for doing that, taking the time out of your day. It's a humble little show. And yes, I've jokingly said this is the greatest podcast that's ever existed, ha ha ha, but I'm proud of the work that I do here, and I'm glad that you are recognizing that and are enjoying it also. So if you like what you hear, go check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages, okay? That's where you'll find us. Go check out becausewenetwork.com for our archive. That's where you get every show of everything we've ever done ever. And don't forget to check out Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podchaser, Pandora, YouTube, Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Podbean, or Amazon Music. That's where you'll find this podcast if you're listening to it on a podcast network you don't usually listen to. So if you listen to this on Apple and you usually go through Spotify or so on and so forth. Or if you stumble across us on YouTube, we actually have a podcast feed. That is in our link tree in the description below. And that is it. So, what else can I say? There's nothing really I can say. There's nothing really I want to say. There's nothing really I could say. I could just babble on about how Sarah found on Facebook the Hulk Hogan subliminal Obey Your Parents, Brother CD. Not CD, vinyl. So yes, that existed. So I could talk about that all day long. I could talk about the implications of that, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say my piece. And I just want everybody to have a good time, be themselves, have fun, look out for one another, love one another, peace and love. Take it easy, everybody. Bye.